Hi, before we get started on this week's show, David Strapinis and I just wanted to comment. This show was recorded earlier by David, myself, and our good friend John. And David, we had a couple of audio problems in recording this show, didn't we?
Apparently the either the recording methodology or the room that John was in or the connection between the rural part of Mexico and the rest of the world was not up to snuff. So, you know, we have pretty high production standards here at the VFX show, and we were debating whether or not to even release this show, but we'd rather put out a podcast that doesn't quite meet our high standards than put out no podcast at all. So,
I mean, the bottom line is if it had been a poor content show, we would have canned it. Actually, we thought the show was really good, and we would really like to get it out there, and we really enjoyed doing it. So ordinarily, we would re-record this. Unfortunately, as you'll hear when we start the show proper, in fact, John is traveling to remote parts of the world, and so it was a miracle to get him on at all, and we've tried in the week or so since we recorded this to re-record it unsuccessfully. So we apologize for that, and we'll try and make sure this doesn't happen again. But right now, we're going to switch gears and cut back to our original recording of the three of us discussing the new Harry Potter film. And again, our apologies for the slight audio problems that will come in the latter third of the recording. Hello and welcome to the VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour for Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And the fellow commentators, reviewers and otherwise critics are John Flowers, who I believe is no longer in San Francisco. John, where are you?
I am currently in Tijuana, Mexico.
Wow. Now, is this the start of your traveling?
Yeah. This is the beginning. We took a train from San Francisco to L.A., stayed in L.A. for a bit, and then went to San Diego, and then from San Diego into Tijuana. And we're going to continue down the Baja coast or peninsula and then cut across via ferry and spend some time checking out ruins and things like that in Mexico.
Well, we're also joined by David Strapinis. Hi, David.
Hello.
But I'm going to get back to John for a second. I'll come back to you, David. So, if you
by the way, when he says he stayed in Los Angeles for a while, I believe the while was like 5 minutes because I like went to lunch and we missed each other to go see this particular movie. And then he's like, I'm in San Diego. And it was a very brief period.
So for those of you that don't know, well, I think most of you would know, but John has a podcast called Life Zero. And if you've been listening to Life Zero, you'd have noticed that it had a hiatus and it came back with the discussion that John is going on what is basically a world tour, or rather an interesting tour of interesting places with his wife. John, just before we get into the VFX show, we won't spend long on this, but just give us the rundown on where you're going, what you're doing, because you'll still be staying in touch with us while you're traveling.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll still be doing a lot of things, including some visual effects work. It's a really interesting thing. My wife, I told her, I said, hey, I want to take a trip and travel and tell me what you're interested in seeing. And so she took some, you know, those little push pins and started putting push pins on a world map. And by the time I knew what had happened, you know, a week had gone by and 150 pins were on the map in every continent. And I said, well, you know, if we're going to see all of this stuff, it's going to take a lifetime. And she said, well, we better get going then, huh?
That's such a good story. So John's going to be traveling light. He's not going on what we in Australia would call the Women's Weekly World Discovery Package Tour. You're actually doing it sort of indie, really. That's probably the best way to describe it, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I have a 35-liter rucksack, and my wife has one as well, and I have a MacBook Air, which I'm recording this on from a, you know, Wi-Fi-enabled place that I'm staying.
Well, we'll be checking in with you as you join us for shows coming up. I just hope that the world of film and visual effects doesn't start to pale into an irrelevant haze of stuff as you travel to these phenomenally interesting places that you're going.
I think John's just gathering material for a new TED Talk.
Okay. And David, you're relaxing in Los Angeles.
I am.
And hopefully enjoying time with your dog and relaxing after having come off a very, very long project, which we spoke a little bit about last week. David, let's start with you. You've had time now to go and see movies such as Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. I need to set this up, I think, by finding out, David, whether you'd seen all the other sort of films and read the books or not, because I think it's going to have a big play on how one views the film.
Yeah, I've seen all the movies, and I had read the first book and didn't really enjoy it. This is back before the movies even came out, and everybody and their brother was reading the books, and I kind of read it and was like, yeah, it's a kid's book, and didn't really enjoy it. So, you know, I enjoy the movies, but I don't really enjoy the book. So never read this particular novel, and this is the first of the movies I didn't actually enjoy.
Oh, really? Wow, that's interesting. Well, this also set it up for you, John. Did you read the books and see the previous films?
I have seen the previous films. I have not read the books. I should point out my wife has read each of the books probably 10 or 12 times, and so she is... whenever you take those Harry Potter tests about how much do you know, she can name everything imaginable. So she is the expert on the books, and I hope that I am much more the expert on the movie. We'll
right.
see,
well,
though.
If you could just hang up and put her on the line, we'd really appreciate it. okay, so my confession is that I didn't start out reading the books, but my entire family was obsessed with it. I have two small girls who are big fans, and then not only did we read the books, we've seen the previous films and got them on DVD and now on Blu-ray, but also we managed to listen to the audio readings by... or the English version of the audio readings, because there's two actual sort of versions of all the Harry Potter books read unabridged. And so I've sat in the car listening to the books, having read the books, having seen the films. So while I personally, I guess, not as obsessive as that sounds, in fact, I was sort of brought to it by this family thing. And so I've got probably a much greater perspective on the books than I would have expected, than I would have had. I don't know if you guys have heard any of the audiobooks, but they're actually, you know, for somebody that I'm not really totally into audiobooks, they're pretty remarkable.
I hear really good things. I hear that, you know, the actor who does the readings does a different voice for every character, and it's supposed to be quite spectacular. I'm a big fan of audiobooks, so...
The English ones are done by Stephen Fry, and I'm sure the American author is good as... the reader is good as well, but obviously being an English-based... set of books, I thought it was interesting to listen to an English actor give the presentation, and I'm a big fan of Stephen Fry from his early comedy days. Have you heard any of them, John?
I have. In fact, for Christmas, I bought my wife the collected 7-book series of the British version of the first edition hardcover, signed, you know, in gold with macro. I mean, it was nuts, like impossible to find version of Harry Potter. And I have listened to the first three, I guess, books, the audiobooks, the British version by Stephen Fry as well, where the first book is actually called The Philosopher's Stone, right?
Yes.
As we know. I actually joked that I thought it was funny that the word philosopher was had such a negative connotation, that the word sorcerer is somehow preferable to people in the U.S. than philosopher.
Yes, I guess it may have conjured up a more... I'm trying not to make any negative aspersions on American subculture, but it might have sort of made it seem less thrilling if it was a philosopher rather than a sorcerer. Hey, so the thing, the reason I mention this is that as somebody that has had to wade through the books in excruciating detail several times, I found the books in this particular case, this particular book, to be really very, very long. And I mean that in a narrative sense. It went into a lot of subtext, a lot of backstory, a lot of motivational stuff that I found just dragged the story immensely. So my first reaction when coming out from seeing the film, when I was sort of doing the, you know, Twitter 170 character summary of the film, was to say that if you had read the books and you knew the films, you'd love this film because it has almost no exposition. It just goes straight into the story, and somebody edited it. So instead of getting, you know, 15 or 20 minutes here and there on the backstory of Riddle's parents or grandparents, you know, it was sort of assumed that he was a bad guy and let's just get on with the story. And most of it stuck with Harry and his mates. As a consequence, knowing the backstory, you know, from the previous films and the stories, I loved the film to death. But I thought if somebody went to see these films having never really been into Harry Potter, they'd have not a freaking idea what the heck was going on. Would you agree with that, David?
Well, I think no one's going to see Harry Potter 6 unless they've seen the first at least 5 movies. But I don't think that if you are adapting a book to a movie, you should have to have that book in order to care about what's going on in the movie. And I really did not care about anything going on in this movie. I mean, the last film The Order of the Phoenix, I thought was the best of all the Harry Potters, even better than the Alphonse Cuarón one. And I thought this one just like, I was like, why is any of this stuff happening? It was coming off of a movie where everything was, I was like, all right, now we're getting to the action. Now we're going to get to the big fight. And it seemed to be 2.5 hours of people sitting around in school, which, why are they still going to school when their entire world is under attack from, you know, Nazi wizards? That makes no sense to me. And it seemed to be 2.5 hours about teenage kids falling in love and experiencing their first kiss and all that kind of stuff, which I realize to people who are fans of the book, that's a really important aspect. But after coming off of a really, you know, I thought this was, or hoping for this was going to be the big, huge battle one, you know, where the Empire Strikes Back of the movies, where it's a big, huge battle and the good guys lose and are set up for the big, their big success in the last movie, okay, which so, I guess is going to be 2 movies.
Yeah.
I was bored to friggin' tears the entire time of this movie.
Okay, so that is exactly not what the book is. The book, I mean, is really basically just setting up for the final book. The film, to a certain extent, sets up for the final film as well. It's by far the least action-packed of the books. It's by far, in my opinion, the most sort of, well, boring, to use a better term, of the books, because there is just so much backstory and setting up. And all that stuff you just described is in the final book. The final book is vastly more action-packed, vastly faster moving than the second last book. Now, of course, for those people that don't know, the last book is being made into 2 films. So what David's referring to there is that they decided to split the last book into 2 separate films coming out 6 months apart, mainly because I think there's just so much in it, and also because it's a terrific way to make money.
Yeah, to milk money, because they're the, you know, it's, yeah, it, but this, then this movie shouldn't have been 2.5 hours, because to me it added nothing. If I saw one more slow-mo shot of Malfoy pulling that cover off of the teleportation box, I was gonna vomit, because
was that
it
not
was like,
the same shot? Did that not seem to you like it was exactly the same shot?
It was the, it seemed to be the exact same shot, but it was, I was like, is he remembering something? Oh wait, no, he's putting something different in the box.
And if he is Malfoy, why did he keep on covering it up? Because it's not in character that he would rip it off like that, be that character, and then meticulously put the thing back the way he found it each time, given that it's in a hidden hiding space anyway.
And every time he put it back on, it magically, well, I guess could have been magically, recovered in dust again, you know?
Well, there we go.
But, and it didn't seem, no matter what time of day it was up there, it was always lit very dramatically for all of them. Like, I just really didn't like this film. It was boring. I'm sure, you know, the only way I'm going to get more hate mail is if I insult Twilight as well. So I don't like that either. We'll just condense all the hate mail into one. But it was, there's just stuff in here that doesn't logically make sense. It's like, okay, so this character Malfoy, his dad has been revealed to be evil Nazi wizard's henchman. And He beats up the chosen one, and yet, oh, he's still in school, you know? And even though he's the principal, you know, Dumbledore's favorite student is the one he beat up, nothing bad happens to him. There's no wizard detention or anything like that. You know, the fact that the school itself has a whole, like, one whole house full of evil wizards, no one sees anything wrong with this, you know? It's just...
Okay, well, now, hang on a second. Okay, just going to pull you up there for a couple of seconds. First thing I'm going to say, I really did like this film. I did like it. I thought it was good. But the second thing is, you live in a world of good things and bad things. The whole point of the Harry Potter universe, you know, it has everything from effectively werewolves to goblins to ghosts. So the idea of having good and bad, I mean, it's not, you know, a school of just pretty kids playing with puppies and making rainbows with their wands. I mean,
yeah,
there is black
fine.
Arts and evil things. And
here's the thing, is if you have that hat that says this is a good wizard and this is a bad wizard, which is basically what that hat does, don't teach the bad wizards to do stuff, you know? Send them off to, like, home ec.
John?
Wow. Yeah, so... First of all, I just wanted to say the sorting hat doesn't sort you into good or evil houses. It sorts you into houses which have a certain disposition. And while it's true that Slytherin, has definitely the ability to turn bad. It's only because Slytherin, that's a house of people who are ambitious and aggressive. And then, of course, those things can turn bad very quickly. But I think it's very black and white to say that it sorts you into good and bad houses, because that's not the case at all.
But before we get too carried away on subtle points of the plot, we will be discussing the visual effects. But in a broader picture, what did you think of the film?
Well, I hesitate to say what I thought of it, because I don't want to come off sounding like I just, you know, violently disagree with David every time we're on the show. Having said that, I would say that I don't think that we've created I don't think technology has advanced sufficiently to create a device that would measure how much I disagree with him. Because I thought that this film was not only the gold standard of visual effects in any Harry Potter movie, or maybe any movie I've seen, but that the plot was so well drawn and so meticulous and so good at setting up the character, the universe, and the future that we're about to see unravel before us, that I just cannot say enough good about it. Fantastic to me.
I'm not going to be like, okay, I'm going to beat you on story, because I do agree. The visual effects were fantastic in this movie, and the cinematography was especially very nice in the movie. But you can't rate a given movie and your enjoyment of a given movie on how it's going to set up the next one.
Why not?
Because then what you get is Unbreakable.
Actually, David, I can.
Yeah, why not?
You may not like it.
Well, no, because if you're going to make... You can't have a whole movie that is disappointing in and of itself.
But I don't think it is
if you are not a fan of the books. And like I think if you guys hadn't read the seventh book and know what's going to happen and how all this stuff had to be set up, you would also agree that this whole movie was pretty boring.
No, I just said that I had not read the seventh book.
And also,
I have not read the book.
I should also say that I disagree with you. Look, we're going to get back to visual effects, but I disagree with you because Dumbledore dies, right? It's not like nothing happens. That's a pretty big thing to happen. It's like
a major character,
if not one of the central characters of the film. It's quite emotional. If you're like you know, the Harry Potter thing, it's like, no, that can't be.
Well, I mean... I don't want to get bogged down in plot forever on this, but he dies after the character who kills him is downstairs, who the whole movie Harry Potter thinks this character is actually on the dark side. He comes up to him and Harry Potter doesn't do anything because this guy goes shush. No, that's stupid. You know, I can dissect all the stupid plot points that are in this movie. Like the beginning of the movie, there's a house that's trash, right? And Dumbledore waves his wand and the house puts itself together. And then suddenly we're supposed to feel bad when a wizard house is set on fire and burns to the ground. Well, apparently they can repair a broken house by waving their wands. There's so much stupidity in these stories about what they do with magic and what they don't do with magic.
Okay, now wait a second. There's a difference between someone who performs a trick, which was to make the house look destroyed so that they would be safe from somebody, like a wizard using a ruse, which is undone, versus a bunch of super evil people trashing your place. It's completely inside the... I didn't have any problem with that whatsoever. It's like, I'm doing a trick to make this house look trash, so you think that I'm no longer here and I'm going to hide as a sofa, which I think was funny, versus some really bad, you know, juju sent down by some really, really bad evil you know, people, because they've had lots of occasions where there are degrees of curses, degrees of magic.
Well, I will not argue that point. Then tell me one thing. Given the information in the movie and the movie alone, why was Harry Potter forced to feed the poison in that basin to Dumbledore? There's no reason why he couldn't have just picked up that little bucket stone, which he uses later, and emptied it out. They gave no reason why it had to be drunk.
I'm pretty sure Dumbledore told him that he had to.
No, Dumbledore ordered him that he had to do whatever he said. But the reason he had to drink it, There's no reason given in the movie why it had to be drunk, why it couldn't have just been scooped out and dumped on the ground. There's lots of little plot points like that that just kind of fall apart.
Okay, I'm going to move off plot points and talk to visual effects. Yeah, because we're clearly in disagreement. But that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I much prefer a show where we have some disagreement. Okay, so let's discuss visual effects. ILM got the lead role on this film, and I personally am just stunned at the depth of ILM's work this season. I mean, four major Hollywood blockbuster films all coming out from ILM. Now, admittedly, they were staggered because of the nature of the fact that the films were finished earlier and then put into sort of on the shelf for somewhere up to 6 months. But nevertheless, you know, ILM's hitting it out of the park this season. If you look at Transformers, Terminator, Star Trek, and Harry Potter. David, I think John's already commented that he thought the special effects were magnificent. I'm totally backing that. I assume you're the same?
Yes, absolutely.
The couple of interesting things in this film that I wanted to discuss, and I'm going to start with an unusual one because it's not specifically visual effects, but I do think it was interesting. I don't know if you guys have seen, but Stu Mashewitz has put up a really interesting video as part of the Red Giant promotion for Colorista, where he dissects the color grading of major Hollywood films this season based on stuff from their trailers, going for what is typically a sort of reduced color palette of a pinky red to a green. And he shows how this is very common in a whole bunch of different films. And then he shows how to get that effect, which is a terrific tutorial if you haven't seen it. My point was that when I was watching this Harry Potter film, having just seen that a couple of days before, I started noticing the color palette used for the grading here. And it made me start thinking about how the color palette in this film seemed pretty different from earlier films. The whole film seems to be set in either winter or a bleak place. And even when there are warm scenes inside, I thought that it was a really, really beautiful grade. Now, Peter Doyle was the head of the grading team, and he was head of the grading team on Lord of the Rings. Was anybody else impressed like I was with the just overall feel and color grading of the film, John?
Yeah, well, as you know, I've done a fair amount of color work myself. And in fact, one of the ways in which I became known as a visual effects guy is because of some of the, you know, low-end tools like Colorista and Magic Bullet Looks that I use to color correct stuff. So one of the things I noticed right away in this film is there's an almost absence of anything in the red, yellow, and orange spectrum. Most of that has just been crushed down, you know, to the point where it's almost black and white. And then the blues, the greens, you know, the things on that side of the color spectrum have really popped, right? And so what you have, you talked about winter and these sort of things. They did a color palette that really did its flat level best to make this film look like it was, you know, almost had a blue cast to it. And then I also noticed that a lot of the scenes in which there are people and they're standing in a building or there's something going on around them, it's almost black and white at the edges and then sort of comes into color, into the center where the person is. I was blown away by the color. The amount of effort that must have been involved to grade this is pretty overwhelming.
Interestingly, and I'm wondering if I'm the same as you on this, I sort of sensed that there was a fair amount of post-production glow enhancement on the people. There seemed to be an almost pro-misty kind of thing happening with a lot of the actors inside Hogwarts. Did you pick up on that, or was that just me?
No, I'm sure, you know, we all saw that, this kind of strange, like, all the wizards glow, and then in certain parts of the movie, you know, I mean, there are scenes where Dumbledore has, like, a freaking halo around him where he's standing there talking to Potter.
What do you think, David?
Like I said, the cinematography was really fantastic. Color grading along with that was really well done, if I thought pushed a little bit. It was more in your face than I think you can normally get away with. Because of the fact that you're noticing it, I think it might be, you know, stating that it may have gone too far. You know, it's one thing to use a different color grade technique or whatever you want to say when you're going for, you know, flashback versus current time, whatever. I really liked how they use that. You know, you can get into a situation a lot like, you know, traffic or whatever, where if you're noticing it, that's a bad thing. I look at color grading a lot. Like I look at you know, the subtle visual effects, you know, like are using contact, like set extensions or what have you, which is if you're noticing it, they've done it wrong. It may have been pushed just a little bit too far, but I thought it was really well done. Like technically very well done. Just artistically, I would have dialed it back like 5%, but that's just me.
I think the thing about it is, if you're going to push the grades to a stylistic level, then this is a good film to do it in. You know, I mean, this is not a film that is unforgiving when you go for a very stylistic approach. There is a lot of ethereal stuff that, you know, you get from that type of grading that just is totally appropriate. The first visual effect that hit me as, you know, my sort of gold standard of, God, I wish I had done that and could put it on my reel, was the pensive stuff when they went in and landed at Tom Riddle's orphanage. It's a sort of a smoke effect, and the smoke comes almost from the, I don't know what you'd call it really, oily ink type swirls that are happening, and then it forms up into people, and then the world kind of forms around it with these, as I say, vaporous kind of dark things. It's not unconnected to the way the Death Eaters travel, but I thought it was original and looked spectacular. Was that something that worked for you, John?
Absolutely, and in fact, it probably was a little bit of overkill for most people, but you know, even the end title credits had that kind of that phenomenal smoke effect where it would come together, form the letters, and then they would dissipate in this strange and inky way. I said, as I was watching this, I said to myself, I said, man, somebody figured out smoke and fire sometime between the last film that I saw and this one, because both the smoke and fire in this were just completely off the charts as far as realism, as far as just the crazy amount of you know, sort of fluid that they had. In fact, there's a scene, as you know, with like fire and water in this film.
And we'll come to that. But I mean, I was impressed with it in the last film when they were after the prophecy and they were in the ministry. There was some really nice work done there.
Yeah. Up until this film, I was saying that that was the best particle work I've seen.
Yeah, but I have to say that I agree, David, totally. But I have to say that, like, the smoke in this film, I mean, it's like the difference between watching Transformers 2 and a Ray Harryhausen film comparing to anything else. It was so good in this film.
It was.
The thing is, I didn't actually read it as smoke. I read it more as, like, you know, ink dropped into water.
Exactly.
You know, which it's still, you know, they're both fluid simulations, but, you know, smoke has a kind of upward feeling, whereas, you know, the ink has a kind of downward, like, settling feeling, and I thought it was great, and it was used a lot in the film, you know, all over the place. It was kind of the signature kind of look for what was going on in the film, and it was really, really fantastic. I thought that was really well done, and I also like the fact that the two looks, you know, between the last movie and this one were done by different houses, and the fact that they were pretty seamless in terms of their feeling, I thought was really good.
Yeah, Mike, what software, by the way, do they use? Because I was reading an article in, I guess, CG, where they were talking about how they had just room after room after room of these, like, 16 processor Linux boxes, just, you know, going like 24/7 for 9 months, just churning out some of the frames for this, but it never said what software was being used under the hood there.
I'm almost 100% sure that ILM stuff is proprietary. ILM has a really long history with fluid stuff. If you remember, they did the boat film that flipped over, Poseidon.
Perfect Storm.
There was that. There was Poseidon. There was like a whole bunch of stuff that I think that fluid sims. There is a couple of companies now. I'm going to not get David to comment on this, but there's actually a company that I've got my eye on that's got some new software coming out that I believe is used on Avatar. David's not going to comment either way, but called Exotic Media out of Sweden, I think, that I'm going to try and hook up with at SIDGRAPH in New Orleans. But the proprietary fluid sim stuff, it's rare to get stuff that has the level of degree of control we're seeing. I really think the individual effects houses are ahead of the curve. We haven't seen the proprietarization of that stuff because I don't think we've got it to a commoditization stage yet. So there's some really, really great stuff on the market already, but yet it's really great stuff for doing one kind of level back from what we're seeing. I mean, your joke then about that lifting between Ray Harryhausen and Transformers 2 to get that high level. I've not seen anything that's off the shelf. Now, I'm hoping that the Exotic Matter stuff is going to be exactly that. And I know they are going to be commercializing it. And I've spoken to the guys at a preliminary level, but I know they're still in just alpha on it. But I believe, again, I'm not asking David, but I believe that's what's used in Avatar. And I believe in this case, this is ILM's proprietary stuff. So leaving David out of it for a second, John.
I believe ILM's actual in-house system is called iParticle.
Right.
So that just to answer the question, that would probably be the system, the name of the software.
And the thing about it is that with any, for those of you that are listening that aren't so familiar, the anything that is a simulation like this really has two distinctive stages. There's a simulation stage and then there's an actual rendering stage. And whereas normally we think of the rendering as being the thing that's sort of a killer thing to do, the simulation stage can be almost as bone crushing. For example, let's discuss something that was well and truly understood now because it's been well talked about, which is Pirates of the Caribbean, and it was a huge end sequence of a spiraling vortex of water, a whirlpool of massive proportions. To hear someone like John Knoll talk about that, and I think he spoke about it last year at SIGGRAPH, you know, the decision to make that a sort of water sim that went down vertically. So obviously, if you've got a plug hole, a whirlpool, it's going to go down in the middle and no longer be a flat ocean, suddenly massively increases the volume involved and thus exponentially pushes the computation through the roof. And so a lot of these, I'm not speaking from any inside knowledge of ILM, but a lot of these simulations are very much three-dimensional in the sense that they're happening volumetrically in every direction. And they would be a horrendous sim to do. And then, of course, you've got the rendering coming after it. I don't know if that answers your question at all, John, but probably not. But I can't tell you from any inside knowledge exactly what they use to do it. The thing about these sims that I love is there's an ability to get a fantasy element in there, but also it has such a grounding in reality that it just feels real, which is ironic because it's absolutely completely unreal and looks nothing like it. And I think for me, just starting with that discussion with going to the orphanage, that was just such a beautiful transition that we've never seen before. Because I think in the earlier movies, and maybe you could comment on this, David, when they used the pensive and stuff, they tended to jump in and then I think they would just sort of either drop in or radically pop in to the scene that they were going into the memories of. But I don't ever remember them forming up like this before. Do you?
Yeah, and no, I don't. It actually, the closest thing that it reminded me to is in the X-Men films when they use Cerebro. And like in the first X-Men film, there's a scene where they went to find Rogue and it was kind of like a gray and like nothingness. And you saw the people kind of forming, like stepping out of smoke. And suddenly it was, you know, getting more and more focused. And it reminded me a little bit of that, but a lot more refined, not because of artistry, but more because of technology. But I really liked that aspect of, you know, using a visual effect as a kind of editorial tool to set the mood and to help tell the story in such a kind of creative way, rather than, you know, doing some kind of editorial trick like a cut or a fade or what have you, but really constructing an editorial change via visual effects, I thought was really nice, and beautifully executed as well. And I thought that the look that was given to the flashback footage, you know, the hyper contrasty, hyper blown out, for lack of a better word, look really was aided by the forming effect, because it reminded me of I don't know how many people have done watercolor work, but you know where you wet the paper
and you
put the ink down and it seeps out, and it was kind of you know, I know Guillermo del Toro was approached originally to work on this film, and it was very much, it had a very illustrative feel, almost as if the whole thing was being painted the whole time. And I thought that it kind of led you into that. So I really like that kind of aspect, and it would be interesting to really, really kind of push that, where if you know, when the actors moved, if they kind of swirled behind them and that faded out and blended into the background, you know, but if you're doing 5-6 minutes of that, you know, suddenly cha-ching, so I can understand why you wouldn't do that, but almost in your brain, you were kind of doing that yourself, so I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, your X-Men reference is interesting at a couple of levels. One, I absolutely love the presidential attack in X-Men and the imploding smoke effect that we saw. I've forgotten the name of the character as he jumps from
Nightcrawler.
Thank you. Yeah, and as he jumps, that void left where he was is a vacuum, and of course it causes the puff of smoke to implode on it. And I thought that was a magnificent visual effect at the time. But the other reason it's an interesting reference is because X-Men was famous for the anti-aging of two of its principal characters at the beginning of the film. And that Patrick Stewart anti-aging stuff was discussed heavily. I'm wondering, how do we feel that Voldemort's anti-aging went in this flashback?
Yeah, well, I was actually blown away by the anti-aging that they did on Professor Slughorn. He was the yep. potions professor who spoke with young Tom Riddle.
Yep.
Tom Riddle, who was ironically played by Ralph Fiennes' nephew. Ralph Fiennes plays Voldemort, speaking of, which I thought was kind of wild. I was like, wow, no wonder they look alike.
I didn't realize that. That's good.
You mean the main arch villain, which we never saw even once in the entire movie?
Actually, we did see him once. There was definitely a montage sequence of flashing frames where his face appeared.
Yeah, yeah. I would argue we saw him a little bit in the clouds at one point as well. And in fact, if you look into the face of the horde of zombies that come out of the water, each of them has a little Voldemort in them.
I think also, by definition, we discussed this whole thing at the beginning, that if you see this film without, you know, knowing the other films, then it would make no sense who the arch-villain was. But we all know it's Voldemort, right? I mean, we all know him so well. And albeit noseless, never quite understood why he was noseless. But yeah, anyway, go on. What did you think of the anti-aging in that flashback? Because that was another pensive flashback.
Yeah, I personally thought that unlike the work done, I guess we talked about Wolverine, of course, before, but unlike that work, and much like the other X-Men movie, it was phenomenal. I couldn't find a single flaw in it.
Well, that's also a situation where the grade helps.
That's what I was going to say. Some of that might have been the grade, the halo effect, the blurring, the, you know, what have you. But come on. I mean, even with grading and blurring and all of these things going on, that is a hard thing to pull off, that quality of anti-aging.
Oh, totally. No, absolutely. I've got to say that when I was watching the film, and this is a complete aside, bit of a rat hole, but I was kind of struck at the time that Maggie Smith looked like she'd aged, and I really like her character in the films and always enjoy her when she's on screen in any film. And it wasn't until we were doing research for this that I discovered, I don't know if you guys knew this, that she'd actually was being treated for breast cancer at the time that they were filming this. Did anybody else notice her looking not perhaps as, which, you know, it's a terribly sad thing that this struck her, I don't mean anything by that, but did anyone else notice that she didn't look perhaps as she has in the past?
Yeah, it would have been kind of the filmmakers to maybe spend a little money doing some digital touch-up on her. I did think she was looking a little worse for wear. But, yeah, I kind of also took that as, you know, her best friend and mentor or whatever Dumbledore was to her just died. So, you know, maybe she was a little broken up about it and spent some time crying. So I thought that was okay. Best wishes. I think she's an incredibly talented actress.
She is, absolutely. So look, Tim Burke and Tim Alexander were the visual effects supervisors on the film, and we need to discuss, I think, the really big scene, the huge discovering the Horlicks, the waves outside going in, the rise of the dead, as it were. we're not going to discuss it from a plot point of view, but Dumbledore's Ring of Fire and all that kind of stuff. Let's pick it apart in the order in which we saw it in the film, which was that they appear on a rock and there's a massive kind of rolling ocean. It's obviously a trailer shot. John, what did you think?
No, I thought the water simulation was... well, I mean, gosh, everyone who's writing about it is saying exactly what I would say if I were writing about it, which is it's, you know, the best water simulation and fire simulation ever put on film. I mean, it's really hard to do anything other than, as you know, I think I started this conversation the same way that I would talk about any aspect of it, which is I truly, deeply, like viscerally at a DNA level think that this is the gold standard for visual effects. I've never seen anything even that comes close. Well integrated, beautiful, breathtakingly huge. And you know, this stuff, this whole film was shot in Cinescope too. I mean, it's 2.35:1. We're not talking about some semi-widescreen, what have you. I mean, I saw it at the Man Chinese Theater, and it was the freaking widest. I mean, I thought I was watching Kundun or something. The thing was so wide.
It really was magnificent. They obviously moved from outside with that terrific water sim and just breathtaking visuals. I mean, exactly what you want for that point in the film. It's building to inside, and there are a bunch of things going on inside. I thought the first thing that they did well was get a sense of scale in what was an otherwise a pretty dimly lit cave. It did feel like a very large space. And then, David, how did you feel it happened when the actual sort of ring of fire broke out and the whole culmination of that scene with fire and smoke and stuff? Because, I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on there, from heat ripples to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, Gandalf looked awesome. That was my one problem with that scene, is literally as soon as that happened, it was so evocative of Gandalf against the Balrog that it was, I thought, odd, you know, an odd way of staging it, that it was so similar with characters that looked so similar. But technically, I mean, the fire was amazing. The underwater stuff was unbelievably realistic, like stunningly realistic. You know, because then you have so much optics to worry about. You know, you have the optics of the camera, you have the optics of the water, you have the interplay of light, you know, across the surface of water, which is reflective, and it was just, you know, so much was dark, but you can't just have darkness. You have to have stuff going on in the darkness. So I'm sure there's lots of artists who slaved away late into the night for stuff that you could barely ever see. It was really, really fantastic, especially when all those golems came out of the water to attack Gandalf. Those were really well done, much better than the I Am Legend zombies. But yeah, I thought it was a really, really well done scene, other than my plot problems with it.
I know we're going to lose you soon, John, for technical reasons, but I guess I just want to get your opinion on the quote zombies, the Infura. It's a difficult thing to have a threatening undead, because in one sense you want them to sort of walk like a zombie, and by that I mean stagger and move slowly. In another sense, not very threatening when you know you can outrun something really easily. And David, I think, brought up a good reference there in that problem that you get where somebody is a zombie and then moves like they've got the agility of an athlete on steroids, versus the threatening nature of having somebody that feels like they're not cognitively thinking their moves as an individual. Do you think that the balance was scored in this, and do you think that's a problem that filmmakers have made for themselves?
I mean, it's the whole night must be blue light problem, right, that I've talked about before. You have certain expectations that you have to meet with the audience, but I think that Tim Alexander really summarized it best. By the way, those are not golems or golems. Those are called Infuri. I would just like to point that out, David. And he said it best when he said that he wanted them to look fleshy. And boy, I tell you, when I obviously read that after I saw them, but I thought to myself, they look fleshy. You know, most zombies look rigid. You know, you made a reference to I Am Legend earlier. Those zombies looked plastic in a lot of ways. They looked very rigid. These zombies looked like flesh. I mean, they looked the way that you might imagine someone with a very severe case of leprosy would look if they were coming out of the water and just falling apart.
I think David Yates also used the term... David Yates also used the term they wanted them to look waterlogged, and I thought they did. I thought that they... At no point did I sort of feel like, well, there's a big cheat on the water there, because they just no longer feel like they're out of the water. I mean, I was watching some film the other night, and, you know, characters came out of the water and seconds later looked completely dry. These did feel waterlogged.
What they reminded me of is, I don't know if anyone else had these as a kid, but sometimes you'd go on, you know, SeaWorld or whatever, and you'd get this, like, you know, whale that would be about the size of your thumbnail, and you'd put him in water, and it would expand out to, like, being the size of your hand. It was like a sponge. Mm-hmm. But they always had – they had a very distinctive, slimy, you know, feel that they just looked spongy and icky and gross, and that's what these things – you know, I was making a joke, by the way, John, that they, you know, they looked a lot like Gollum from Lord of the Rings because the whole scene looked like Gandalf versus the Balrog. You know, that they kind of they had the disgusting feel. But this is actually one situation where I think a movie versus a book kind of fails because it's a kid's book. So however the kid is imagining these things to look is as frightening as that kid can imagine it. So they're going to be scared. But because you have to keep this to being a PG movie, you know, most of the Harry Potters are G. This is only the second one to be PG. You know, if this had been a hard R Harry Potter, you know, I'm sure the zombies would have been a lot more or inferior if you want to be, you know, not really tick off all the fans, would have been a lot more disgusting and falling apart and, you know, bones and bloodiness and all that kind of stuff. So I think this is one of those situations where you're limited by your rating. But I thought it was kind of interesting how when they did the crowd sim, they put them on cards, like just flat, you know, cards, which is a good trick, but then they just, you know, normal mapped them to get the lighting effects to look kind of right on it. Like, I'm like, that's just cool, the fact that they're using basic games technology in their final rendering. I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, we're going to lose John and we probably need to finish up soon, but I will say that the Horrocks is the nature of the basis of the next two films. And this whole idea of the big battle that you felt you didn't have, David, is, I'm not giving anything away when I say, boy, the final book delivers in spades. And I think there's one other really terrific aspect, which is if the films to come stay up with the book, we get to revisit a lot of terrific, terrific characters in the final two films, which is great. I do laugh every time I see these films as we kind of watch. I feel like we're watching 7 Up and 14 Up and 21 Up as we see the actors age. But either luck or brilliant casting, I do actually think we should mention how well I think all of the actors are aging into these roles. And I just think it's a joy to watch. So, John, I know you've got to go, but hopefully you will stay in touch with us as you travel.
Well, I'm hoping I'll get invited to future VFX shows. I do enjoy seeing a good movie and talking about the visual effects.
Well, we certainly hope that you will. And when people want to sort of follow you, it is the same kind of, I mean, basically, while you've stripped everything down, you're still pretty much technologically as wired as you were before, almost, give and take internet.
Yeah, the internet is obviously the big issue because it certainly becomes more sporadic depending on where I'm at in different parts of the country. But, you know, follow me at LifeZero on Twitter or LifeZero.org. Or, you know, I'd encourage you, I appreciate you mentioning it earlier, I would encourage people to listen to the LifeZero podcast. I really feel like I've pushed a really big red reset button on that to try and turn it into, you know, the thing that I want to talk about, which I hope is the thing people want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I am stunned at your ability and self-control to go to the level of paring down that you have, and I enjoy listening to your journey as you take it. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, John, stay
absolute
safe.
Absolute pleasure. Oh, thanks. Absolutely.
And we're going to lose John now, but David, do you want to give out our thanks to our team behind the scenes that have produced the show?
Oh, absolutely. VFX Show is a combo production between Pixelcore and FX Guide. And our producer is Kristen Martin. She's also the editor of the show. And today's research was done by Lori Apthorpe. So thank you very much, Lori. And you can get a hold of all of our show notes at vfxshow.com. And to answer your next question before you even ask it, Mike, people can find me on Twitter at David Strapinis and at Facebook at facebook.com/David Strapinis. You can send all your you don't get Harry Potter or Twilight hate mail to David at vfxshow.com.